busiest summer school season ever. What pandemic practices will stick around? And Juneteenth is now a federal holiday. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Summer is here for school students, parents, and teachers, but tens of thousands of students are expected to be in summer school. How do South Florida school districts hope to make up for the COVID slide after more than a year of pandemic learning? Then, the virus remains, but emergency rules and restrictions are disappearing. Streets that were closed to help restaurants serve outside may reopen to traffic. Restaurants may be moving back inside, but to-go booze is now permanently legal. And we will talk with the South Florida Congresswoman who was at the White House as President Biden made Juneteenth a federal holiday. It's all ahead on our program, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. Recognize that sound? South Florida schools officially out for the summer as of today. Monroe County wrapped up the year on May 28th. Miami-Dade and Broward ended the academic year last week. And today, on this Friday, it is the last day of school in Palm Beach County. Well, it was certainly a challenging year for everyone, students, educators, families, everyone navigating schooling during a pandemic. Students, parents, and teachers, what kind of school year was this like for you? We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, share your stories on the school year that is just wrapping up. And is summer school part of your plans this summer? Will your children be attending summer school? Will you be teaching classes this summer? 800-743-WLRN as we open up our phones on this Friday afternoon across South Florida. 800-743-9576, talking about summer school for the busiest and perhaps most important summer school session ever. You can also tweet us your thoughts at WLRN on Twitter. Summer school this year will be the busiest many school districts have ever experienced, trying to prepare students for the return to in-person learning this fall. So what can you expect from summer school this year in South Florida? How are schools, parents, teachers, students preparing for it? Your phone call is coming up in a moment, 800-743-WLRN. To help us give some of the lay of the land for summer school plans in Palm Beach County, I spoke with Palm Beach Post reporter Andrew Mara on Thursday. Andrew, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. How many Palm Beach County students are expected to actually attend summer school this summer?
The last report I heard was about more than 13,000, which is, I want to say, at least 5% of students, so way more than in a normal year.
And is that attendance by choice or by mandate?
It's largely by choice. They are strongly suggesting kids who are behind do attend. They really do the hard sell. I think most of it is not being mandated. Most of these kids aren't necessarily in danger of repeating the grade, but they've been, you know, their families are being told, look, your kid's behind, you need to put some extra time so he or she doesn't fall further behind.
I was going to ask you how the district determines whether or not a student is at grade level, behind grade level, or ahead of grade level, especially considering the COVID pandemic school year that's just wrapping up today in Palm Beach County.
A lot of it is diagnostic testing, of course, grades. They earlier in the year, grades were a real sort of early canary in the coal mine. Back in the fall, even, I think in October, they noticed just a huge spike in the number of kids with F grades who just because they weren't completing classwork or what have you. And that really put them on notice that there was a big problem. And this is happening around the country, of course. But and then, you know, diagnostic testing has also shown kids aren't quite making the yearly progress they're usually expected to. So it's been, I believe, a combination of both. It depends on the grade level in the class, of course.
So how will summer school work? What's the plan look like for a student, for a parent in Palm Beach County who may be attending summer school?
So again, it depends on the grade level, but most schools, I believe, are going to have some sort of summer school set up at their sites. Not all of them, but and that's a bit of a change because in past years, you know, summer school was pretty sparse. It was really just for a few specialized things. There was, you know, kids who had failed the third grade state reading exam and needed to retake it. So there's a lot of that. Kids in high school who had failed classes and needed to make them up for credit. So at the high schools, there was a good bit of that. But now it's sort of all hands on deck. and they're going to have lots of teachers, far more teachers teaching this summer than normally. They actually just agreed to give teachers an extra stipend to incentivize them to keep teaching during the summer after what's been a long year. It's just a really massive sort of, you know, flooding the zone with resources this summer, and that's really kind of unprecedented.
So students in Palm Beach County who may be attending summer school could be attending at their home school as opposed to normally only just a handful of buildings would be open for summer school, right?
That's right. Yeah, a lot more schools are going to have summer school programs on campus than in the past. I don't know the exact number. It's going to be a lot more sites. A lot more schools will be operating and functioning this year than in previous years.
And only in person, or is there a virtual summer school option?
There is both, I believe. They're really strongly encouraging everyone to do in person because, you know, they've come to the conclusion that's just a lot more effective. But I believe for some kids, there's going to be a virtual option. So that's still going to be on the table.
You mentioned the teachers. What can you share with us? Are district union teachers being used for summer school? Are they signing up for the stipend?
Yeah, they just agreed to a stipend just recently. You know, in addition to the hourly pay they would get, teachers who work in the summer, of course, always get extra money. But they're also going to be getting sort of a $500 or $1,000 incentive on top of that, sort of as like a signing bonus for the four-week summer program. And obviously the fact that they're doing that shows you how concerned they are about getting enough teachers to do it. And I don't know the numbers. I think they're recruiting currently to try and get enough teachers to do this. So I'm not sure exactly how far they've gone in their progress, but there obviously is concern they won't have enough.
What about the source of funds in the budget? This kind of expanded summer school was not even imagined 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And luckily, there's been a lot of federal stimulus money over the last year that has come down and really helped to shore up the budget and expand it for some of the stuff. So a lot of this is being done because of the federal stimulus money. They'll be able to use some of that to plug holes in the budget that they might have had otherwise, not just for the summer, but next year when they're expecting a revenue shortfall because they expect some enrollment decreases.
What's the goal of summer school? And I don't mean that question to be so elementary sounding as it sounds, but 4 weeks to try to fill in some of the gaps, the COVID slide that a number of students may have experienced over the past 15 months.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And you're right. I mean, typically summer school is sort of thought of as a way to check a box that just wasn't checked over the past year. You know, you didn't get the score you needed on an exam. You didn't get the passing grade you needed. Obviously, that is a component here, but really it's more about just undoing months of lost learning because kids, they just literally weren't in the classroom as often. And there was a tremendous cost to that we're seeing. And so it's about kind of undoing some of the losses by basically extending the school year and trying to get as many kids in person as possible who maybe throughout this year were not in person at all.
Andrew Morrow covers education for the Palm Beach Post in Palm Beach County. Andrew, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
800-743-WLRN to join our conversation. What was this pandemic school year like? What does summer school look like for your family, students? Maybe you're a teacher or a staff member at a school. 800-743-9576. Debbie is in West Palm Beach. Debbie, thanks for listening and calling. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Thank you. We're so glad to join you. I'm here with my daughter, who just finished third grade, and my son, who's just wrapped up fifth grade, so we're excited he's moving on to middle school. And I just want to say really thank you to all of the teachers in Palm Beach County. It has been quite a strange year, and I imagine very challenging for them as well as for us as parents and for my children as students. They did virtual for a period of time, and then we switched back to on-site because we found that that was better for them academically and socially. So this year, we've all been learners, in a sense, in how to support each other through this. So just I have so much gratitude for our educators. And for summer school, we're actually going to give them a break. We're going to let them do summer camp. So they're really excited for that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Debbie, it sounds like they're lucky to have you as their mom, a rising fourth grader and a rising sixth grader now. Congratulations. Yes. You made it through the school year, and your kids did too. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I love to hear it. Great.
Thank you. Thank
you for sharing this last day of school in Palm Beach County with us here on the South Florida Roundup. That's wonderful to hear. 800-743-9576. All public schools will be out. Summer is officially underway for public school students, public school families, public school teachers, instructors, staff members. And then, of course, perhaps the most important, busiest summer school session is about to get underway. Jessica Bakeman covers education for us here at WLRN. Scott Travis is the South Florida Sun Sentinel education reporter. To both of you, welcome back. Great to hear from Debbie and her children there, graduating third grade and fifth grade, taking the summer off. Jessica, tens of thousands of students are not taking the summer off in Miami-Dade County because of summer school. What can you share with us about the plans in Miami-Dade County?
Well, I would say that I'm smiling ear to ear after hearing that sweet thank you from Debbie's child. And, you know, Debbie said that her kids are going to do summer camp. That's pretty much what Miami-Dade County School Public Schools is trying to simulate for the students who are participating this year. They are putting on what's called the Summer 305 Adventure, which the district says is the most expansive summer programming seen in decades. As of Wednesday, more than 52,000 students were enrolled, which is about 10 times as many students as typically enroll in summer programs. In the past, it was something like 1.5% of students in the district are taking part in summer programs, and this year it's 15%. So obviously that's a huge, huge difference. But basically what the school district did was partner with the Children's Trust, which is a nonprofit in the community that offers more than 300 camps, summer camps in Miami-Dade. And so they're working together to infuse academic instruction, to bring teachers, to bring materials to those camps. And the program seems to be really comprehensive. There are so many different options. There are, you know, different options for whether you're in elementary or middle or high school. Some of the camps are, you know, specifically math, specifically foreign language immersion, specifically like the Adventure Backpack Program, one of them is called. And one change for this year as well is that typically summer school is only for second and third graders for elementary. And this year it's pre-K through 12. Anybody in any of those grades can participate.
It's a massive expansion of summer school compared to pre-pandemic, pre-COVID summers. Scott Travis with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Share with us Broward's plans and expectations. I think they get underway on Monday next week. Scott, are you still with us? I think we may have lost Scott on Zoom, but we'll get back to him in a moment.
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Go ahead, Scott. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Sorry about that.
That's
all right. So I wanted to just correct one thing that you said, that Broward County is not offering summer school. They're offering a summer experience, because one of the things
and
that
so
they
what,
have
what,
found.
Why is that important? I mean, it is an important distinction, but tell me why.
It is actually every school district I found is not, none of them are naming it summer school, at least not their primary name, because they find that that has a stigma to it. It conjures up images of the kind of slacker student who needs to go and make up credits to graduate from high school. So you know, you can't make it during the regular year, so you got to go to summer school and stuff like that. And they really wanted to present a different image this year to say that this is going to be for everybody. It's not just, yes, there will be a major focus on the kids who are struggling, falling behind, especially during the pandemic, but also ones that maybe fell a little behind, or maybe ones that are doing fine, but just wanted some enrichment. And, you know, I talked to a parent who, is actually his kid's doing great, but he said, you know, this is like free summer camp. They're offering all these different programs, and it's a lot cheaper than going to the YMCA.
Strike the balance, Scott and then Jessica, about a camp like experience, and I guess what that conjures up in the minds of a parent and a student and a teacher, and a summer school type experience. In other words, the balance between, I guess, kind of more recreation, socialization, and academics that's going to be happening this summer in public schools in South Florida. Scott?
Yeah, well, I think probably one of the key differences is that they're going to try to make it extremely engaging. Lots of hands-on activities. There's going to be theater, drama, debate, robotics, a lot of things that really kids, like maybe you kind of sneak in learning and they don't even realize that it's happening. So they want to make it very engaging. And there'll be like a lot of the Broward programs, they'll maybe have 45 minutes of academics, then they'll have maybe 30 minutes of either a fun activity or social emotional learning or something that's a little bit different so that it doesn't feel like the mundane school experience.
Jessica, how about that experience for Miami-Dade County students this summer who will be in a classroom or in a school setting, that balance between socialization, recreation, and just, you know, cracking the textbooks open?
Right. I think what the school district is trying to do is create something fun that kids are going to really want to participate in, because as you've mentioned, and as our listeners probably know, just as well as we do, if not better, it's been a really tough year and a half as far as, you know, the second half of last school year, all of this school year being disrupted by COVID-19. People are so sick of staring at a computer screen. We still had huge numbers of students, even though schools were open in all of South Florida school districts that stayed home. Broward most notably had a big majority of students who didn't come to school in person. And so I think the school districts are just like, we need to give families an option to do something that seems like more fun than just more of the same sitting, staring at a computer. And so, you know, most of the programs are in person. There are virtual options as well, but they're just trying to make it fun. And then also at the same time, while you're here for the whole summer, let's try to help you catch up on some of the stuff you might've missed out on during these really difficult school years.
And is it volunteer or are some students required to attend?
I am not 100% sure if there are any students who are required, but I think it is mostly voluntary. However, I will say that the school district did not get as many students as they wanted because the school district was targeting 65,000 students, which is about a quarter of enrollment in traditional public schools, and saying to those families, like, your kids really need extra help. Like, we really need to see them this summer. And, you know, they ended up getting 52,000. So there's still a lot of kids, but it's not as many as they hoped for.
Yeah. Let's hear from Mark in Miami, who, Mark, I think you mentioned to our producer, you've been homeschooling your children.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a 9-year-old daughter, and before COVID, we were already a little trepidatious, just basically with the obsession with testing and stuff. But then when COVID hit and the prospect of, like, the previous person that was talking said of her staring at a screen for 6 hours at a time was just an absolute non-starter for us. So we kind of came up with our own little syllabus and activities and supplemental socialization things. And we went through that, and she flourished so well that even though I'm happy that everything's going back to normal, we're going to go ahead and keep going with our plan of homeschooling and enrolling her in as many other activities as possible to supplement.
Yeah. Mark, I appreciate you calling and listening, sharing that story. Congratulations on getting through the school year of homeschooling. And it sounds like it worked out so well. It's going to continue there. Mark in Miami here joining us on the South Florida Roundup, talking about summer school experiences for public school students. 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Scott Travis covers education in Broward County for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Jessica Bakeman covers education for us here at WLRN. Let's talk about teachers, the kind of demand that the increase in attendance for these summer experiences, so-called summer experiences, Scott. Enough staffing for Broward County?
My understanding is that they did get at least enough teachers that wanted to apply, but they may not have all been in the correct grade configuration. So maybe they needed more elementary teachers and they got more high school teachers or something to that effect. But one of the things they did say is that even if they don't get enough, they are able to have teachers teach out of field, because this is not the normal school year where you get dinged if you have a teacher that's not in their subject. So they may be having some teachers that they may be teaching something that's not their normal area of specialty.
Not the normal school year. Boy, that's the headline. And it has been the headline for the past year and a half, certainly. And likely to continue this summer. Scott Travis covers education for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Jessica Bakeman, the education reporter at WLRN. Jessica and Scott, thanks again, as always, for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
We've got more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. We want to tell you that June is Pride Month. You know that. It's time to celebrate LGBTQ plus people and reflect on the milestones of the movement. We're interested in hearing what Pride means to you. Next week here on our program, we will be reflecting on Pride Week, Pride Month, rather, and we want to hear what Pride means to you. Email us your thoughts now. Talk to us at WLRNnews.org. Talk to us at WLRN.org, and we'll be talking with you about Pride Month next week here on the South Florida Roundup. Still to come now, COVID restrictions in Florida have been lifted. So what are some of the pandemic-related practices that might just stick around? Takeout ordering, food delivery apps, to-go booze? What practices will you continue doing? Which ones are you happy to do away with? Join us now live on this Friday, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. More to come. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting public radio. It's been more than a year since the coronavirus upended our lives. Restrictions related to the germ are lifting in South Florida. Emergency orders are being rescinded. So now what? Does life just go back to the old normal? Will you continue using COVID practices like wearing a mask, trying to maintain social distancing out in public, or doing away with that if you're double vaccinated? Share your thoughts. Call us 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And what about commerce? What about business? Are outdoor dining, restricted capacity limits, street closures, will any of that stick around? We want to hear from business owners, managers, employees. What COVID practices are you doing away with? And what will you be keeping? What practices will stick around in the so-called new normal? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Daniel Rivero is with us, reporter at WLRN. Daniel, let's talk just specifically about street closures. You did some reporting on this week. A number of streets were closed in South Florida because of the pandemic. Where were they closed? How were they used?
Right. So one of the most prominent ones internationally, if you want to look at it because of the amount of visitors that you get, is Ocean Drive on South Beach. Pretty early on in the pandemic, that the county and the city decided to close it to allow more space for outdoor dining and just give more space for pedestrians to walk around. You know, that strip was often just kind of clogged with traffic, and they figured that opening it up to people walking and expanding the outdoor space for the cafes and the bars would just be better for social distancing. And, you know, another place that's happened is in downtown Doral. Northwest 53rd Street in downtown Doral was opened in very much the same way. Cafes, bars, more outdoor seating. Fuller Street in Coconut Grove was closed down. You know, it's a thriving place now. It's kind of a community gathering place where people gather. And in the Gables, there was another street that was temporarily closed. Yeah.
Describe the closed streets. You visited a few of these. What's the scene like?
Right. Well, I mean, last week I went to Fuller Street in Coconut Grove, and I had been there before. And it's basically like a Lincoln Road kind of feel, you know. A lot of us know Lincoln Road. Obviously it's a landmark place in South Florida on South Beach. And, you know, closing some of these streets has given some areas that same kind of vibe. It's a people watching place. You can sit down on a bench, order a beer, order a sandwich, just kind of hang out under the shade. And there's no cars around, so you don't have to worry about ducking and dodging traffic and stepping in between cars when you're there. It's really almost a park-like feel.
Yeah, well, you may have encountered Alec. Alec is on line one from Coconut Grove. You want to talk about just this street closure? It's a small street. It's only one block squeezed right in there off of Main Highway, Alec. What's the experience like for you?
It's been really great. You know, my wife and I lived in Coconut Grove for quite a while and have since moved after the pandemic. And, you know, Fuller Street and the businesses around it, they provided sort of a refuge during lockdown for us. It was just a couple blocks away. We felt really, really sort of safe there, you know, as safe as you could feel during this pandemic. And you know, I think just for the community, it's brought a lot of people together. One thing I did want to touch on very briefly was that I know that the, you know, the Florida Department of Transportation is sort of involved here in preventing the street closure because it's a one-way street. You can't make a right on the main highway from Grand Avenue. So I'm really hoping that they can find a way around that and keep Fuller Street closed.
Yeah. Alec, you bring up an important point there in terms of just the regulators. Danny, kind of who has the voice in reopening these streets or in the efforts to perhaps continue to restrict traffic, if not to eliminate it altogether?
Right. So just to back up for a second, the closures that are there right now, they're going to be rescinded at the end of the month because Governor DeSantis made an order basically ending all COVID orders, emergency orders. And this would mean that those streets under emergency orders need to reopen. So now in Miami-Dade County, the county is stepping in and saying, okay, because the county is the one that issues those permits. And they're saying, if you want to keep these streets open, we will work with you. We will help you along with that now. And there is a movement in Coconut Grove to keep Fuller Street open. The city of Miami Beach is trying to figure out exactly what it wants to do with Ocean Drive. They are facing some pushback from hotels that want people to be able to drive up with their luggage. Right now, some people have to walk a couple blocks with their luggage. And in Doral, the government there says that they're not going to pursue keeping 53rd Street closed. But some of the bars and the restaurants there are pretty vocal. They want it closed, so they might pursue that on their own.
Yeah. We're talking about some of the pandemic practices that may or may not stick around in South Florida. Danny Rivero is a reporter here at WLRN. What practices did you pick up or what kind of business practices have you seen that you've participated in? Takeout ordering, for instance, QR codes for menus, right? Or to-go booze. It's now legal in Florida. Yeah, the legislature passed the law and the governor signed it here during this pandemic. 800-743-WLRN to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. Adam Gersten is with us now, owner of Gramps Bar in Wynwood. Adam, have you used streets to serve? Tell us about some pandemic practices that may stick around at Gramps.
Sure. Well, we have, we're lucky enough to have a lot of outdoor space. So we actually did not do the street closure, though I did actually enjoy Barracuda through the pandemic on Fuller. So I'm a big fan of that, and I think it's great, and I hope that they can keep it. As well as Over Under used a parking spot on Flagler, or a couple parking spots, which I think was really practical and and great. We did the QR codes. We also tried to, you know, we had hosts. We never had hosts. You know, it was a kind of walk on in kind of place. So, you know, that was a new thing for us to seat people. And you know, while we have sort of moved away from that in the last couple of weeks, that's only temporary because we actually found that so many people were enjoying sitting with their friends and being served and not interrupting conversation. And the drinks were coming out faster, you know, instead of waiting in line behind, you know, on a Friday or Saturday when the bar is 3-4 deep. So we're actually spending a fair bit of money and time trying to now bring back a sort of reservation system and table seating, limited, you know, I'd say like maybe, 20% of our space, you know, floor space for that. So that people can come in a group and sit down and, you know, they're not going to get, it's not like, mega club, bottle price gouging, you know, type of, you're not going to be punished for wanting to sit.
Right.
But we do want people to be able to do that because we found that so many people loved that experience. Yeah. So that's something that's sticking around for sure for us.
The pandemic forced a change in the business model in so many restaurants because of the restrictions. And as the restrictions have been lifted, Adam telling us that some of those pivots may stick around because you see some business opportunity there. John Burnett also with us, a partner of Taquiza Tacos. John, welcome to the program. Did you take advantage of closed streets or sidewalks or other outdoor space to serve?
Yeah, thank you for having us. Yeah, we did. It was pre-pandemic. We were, our original location was fast casual, and then we ended up having a couple spaces which we thought lent themselves more to full service. And it was very hard to operate in that fashion, and we always wanted to make a change. And so when the pandemic hit, it was maybe a silver lining that we could retool everything back to fast casual, back to counter service. And we ended up doing QR codes. The city let us put outside picnic tables, which helped a great deal. The public wanted it anyways. And then our POS provider then made a
point
of
service.
Subtle,
yeah, POS, point of service.
Exactly. Yeah. And they made a very interesting change to have table-specific QR codes. Huh. And we use that all the time now. And it is great. People don't have to stand in line. They can order from the table. We know where they are. We can run it out. And that level of efficiency really helped. So I think that's going to stay. And I think more and more people are taking advantage of these kind of hybrid models between full service and fast casual.
Yeah.
So that's been really positive.
John Burnett, partner at Tequiza Tacos, Adam Gersten, owner of Gramps Bar in Wynwood, Danny Rivera, WLRN reporter, talking about pandemic practices, particularly in restaurants that may stick around. 800-743-WLRN. Scott is in Key Biscayne. Scott, thanks for your patience. You're on the radio now.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, I think two of the things that we're going to continue doing is mask wearing and probably using the curbside service if we're not going into a restaurant, because that's been really just a great little thing to do when we're not in the mood to cook at home. So and I'd like that.
Yeah. Scott, that's a great topic there. Let me put that to John and Adam. What about any curbside service or takeout? The great pivot of the spring of 2020 for so many restaurants in South Florida was to amp up that takeout menu when you may not have had it at all or it was a very minor part of the business. John, what about at Tequiza Tacos, the takeout and the pull-up business?
You know, we have steady takeout. We also have kind of integrated delivery through our point of sale. However, I think for us, in the very beginning, when we were only takeout, then curbside was more used. But I think the efficiency through QR codes and that you don't really have to wait, I think that helps just people walk in, maybe have a drink, pick up their stuff and go. So we don't necessarily have curbside, per se, but a lot of takeout and efficiency through the other developments. Yes.
Adam, your experience at Gramps?
Yeah, we sort of similar. We did go through a period when we got our first PPP round that we tried to just, you know, but we weren't really allowed to have people around. So we tried to do the
Paycheck
curbside.
Protection Program.
I think the big lesson for us, one, is the type of food that, you know, we have 20-inch pizzas. They don't travel well. So I guess it's more about what I would not do on my next ventures. So I learned a lot about packaging and things like that. And also learned from other folks that did it so well. So I guess more it was a lesson of what not to do or what you can't, what won't work, you know. And I think the square peg in a round hole stuff, I think there were a few of us that struggled a little more to make some of that stuff work. But it also has informed, like, I think takeout and delivery is such a huge part of you know, revenue for most places that it, like I said, it's affecting how I'm planning the stuff I have in the pipeline, so that, you know, so it was a learning experience.
Yeah. Just a couple minutes left here, Adam and John and Danny, but for the two restaurant owners and partners, Adam, you first, how are employees reacting to some of the pandemic practices and the conversations you are having about what sticks around in terms of, you know, distancing, mask wearing, service, that kind of thing. Adam?
Yeah. I put everything to the staff, and basically it was their choice when we decided to roll that stuff back. And then it became a matter of how quickly we could sort of get back to being able to handle more full capacity. And so they're 100% sort of driving that ship. Yeah. And they're loving it, and they love being back to being bartenders again, although they are happy to do some of the table service as well.
John, how about the keys to tacos?
Yeah, I think it's the same. I think it's largely in the hands of the staff and public. There's always, I think, a transition of comfort level, and you never know exactly where somebody's going to be. And so we had a conversation of, you know, now that state of emergency is lifted and all that, that we, of course, do our normal precautions, but as far as mask wearing and all of that, it's really I think an individual's personal comfort level choice. Otherwise, you kind of put yourself in a position of maybe not being able to please anybody, and I think it's now kind of towards the general public to decide.
And Danny Rivero, ahead of another weekend, and as John mentioned, the emergency orders being lifted here, expiring, what's the future for those barricades around some of those streets that have been closed off? What to look for in the future?
Right. Well, the county is asking them to, if they want to reapply under non-emergency permits, and they're saying they will expedite those if they're actually submitted. I think in the broader sense, though, the pandemic, not just in South Florida, but in a lot of parts of the country, is making local governments reevaluate mandatory parking space restrictions, which is just how a lot of zoning works.
Yeah.
So the county has already taken some steps to make more permanent the ability of restaurants and bars to just take over a parking spot or two in their parking lot and do outdoor seating. Yeah. You're starting to see some creative thinking on things like that. So that's in the long term, I would say.
Danny Rivero, reporter at WLRN, Adam Gersten, owner of Gramps Bar in Wynwood, John Burnett is partner of Tequiza Tacos. All three of you, thanks for sharing your experience with us here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Next week here on the South Florida Roundup, we will be reflecting on Pride Month, and we'd love to hear what Pride means to you. You can email us now your thoughts, your experiences, share your stories, talk to us at WLRN.org. Email your thoughts, talk to us at WLRN.org. We'll be talking and reflecting on Pride Month next week on our program. Still to come now, Juneteenth becomes a federal holiday. We'll talk with the South Florida Congresswoman who was with President Biden this week when he made it official. 800-743-WLRN for our conversation, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Florida was one of the first states to observe June 19th as Juneteenth. That was in 1991, 126 years after the day it recognizes, June 19th, 1865, when a Union Army Major General arrived in Galveston, Texas, announcing the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed 2.5 years earlier, freeing enslaved people. This week, Congress approved and President Joe Biden signed into law Juneteenth as a federal holiday, June 19th, Juneteenth National Independence Day. So what does this national acknowledgement mean to you? There are celebrations and commemorations across South Florida this weekend. What statement does this new federal recognition make as Florida limits how history is taught in public schools? 800-743-WLRN. Frederica Wilson is the U.S. House of Representatives Congresswoman representing the 24th Congressional District in Miami. Representative, welcome back to WLR. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Wonderful to have you. Tell us about Thursday, yesterday at the White House, as President Biden made June 19th a federal holiday. You were alongside the president.
I was, and it was just absolutely wonderful. It was such a reckoning on what we've been fighting for so many years. And to have President Biden come into office and just with the swipe of a pen, oh my goodness, make this all a reality. Appreciate it so much. It was wonderful.
Presidents oftentimes use multiple pens to sign legislation. Did you?
He did. He had many pens and he was passing them out as he signed. It was just fabulous. And the people were crying. I was crying. I just was so emotional. Finally, it was just so emotional.
The pen may seem like a small gesture. Did you receive one?
I did. I have a pen. I'll show it to you. I have a pen.
what will you do with it?
Most of the people in the room got a pen. It was just that close knit, and it was just that emotional. It was the president knew that it meant a lot to a lot of people, so he had a lot of pens.
Yeah, I appreciate you. answering my questions about the pens, but it is just such a momentous occasion. This piece of legislation, this idea that you have been recognizing, have been pushing for a good number of years. I wanted to ask you, though, about some of the process here that led to Thursday, because this particular piece of legislation came together very quickly in terms of congressional timeframes. It was introduced in February. It really didn't see much activity until this week, and it went from a proposal to pass legislation in the Senate and the House to the president's desk and to his signature. How did all this come together?
Well, I think what happened was Senator Markey decided that he wanted to pass this bill prior to the actual Juneteenth holiday, which is something that we commemorate, but it's not a federal holiday, and it has never been designated as such. Right. So he passed it on a voice vote in the Senate. And so that means that unanimously it was passed in the Senate, and then they sent it to the House. And after it reached the House, of course, everyone in the House was excited. So we put it in the proper procedure to move it fast through the process so that people could vote. Yeah. And it almost passed unanimously in the House, but we had 14 nays right. in the Republican Party, but then it swiftly went to the president's desk. And when he got it, he realized the importance of it and the importance of getting it signed prior to June 16.
Tell us about the meaning, the real meaning of this recognition, particularly to go further about beyond the acknowledgement of a day, of a holiday, but toward substantial legislation, voting access, for instance. How does this legislation affect those larger, more systemic efforts?
I think that I think that what this particular bill signing did was open, well, this delivered on a promise of equity. It's not everywhere, but it's an opening. And I think after the murder of George Floyd, many of our colleagues begin to understand, and they begin to view racism, and I guess you would say racial inequities, through much clearer lenses. So I think this is truly an opening that is an important day in history, and we acknowledge it. But I think that we have so much further to go, because in fact, the gap between rich and poor has only grown wider since we passed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, which was a reckoning on us. And we all thought that things would be better. Even though we've made some progress, we're see the light at the end of the tunnel, but we're still in the tunnel.
The recognition of Juneteenth comes just days after the state Board of Education approved a rule banning certain race-related teachings from public schools here in Florida. Can Florida public school teachers, do you think, Representative Wilson, teach students about Juneteenth under the new state rule?
I think that public school teachers can teach whatever they want to. And I think it's an abomination to our state, to our nation, for someone to even think of passing legislation like that. I mean, that's abhorrent, and it's a shame. It's a shame that they would even put something like that in the law books of the state of Florida.
But it is there, Representative.
It is there. However, being a teacher myself, mm-hmm. we all know that children ask questions, and teachers have the right to answer those questions. We also know that there are resources and resource books that teachers can use that will include Juneteenth. Now, they may not be able to use school funds to buy those resources, but I'm willing to bet you that even with the passage of this bill, children will know more about Juneteenth than that would ever have been taught in the schools.
Go ahead, Congresswoman.
And I think that when I was thinking about it and when I saw what the governor did and being so very passionate about education and passionate about African-American history, I have a group of pastors that I work with, and it will get taught. Might not get taught in the public schools the way we think it should get taught, but we know how to teach children without having some sort of roadblocks put in front of them.
I have less than a minute left, Congresswoman. Do you think it won't be taught because of this rule, that some teachers will shy away from a full discussion?
Some may shy away, but if children ask questions, they have the responsibility to answer those questions. And they are going to ask questions. And they're going to ask questions because it's so much happening in the world today. Yeah. And you can't shy away. If you're a history teacher, an English teacher, a social studies teacher, or whatever, the homeroom teacher, whatever it is, a 5,000 role model sponsor, right, you're going to teach it. Going to teach it.
Representative, we appreciate your time today. Thank you for spending it with us here on WLRN.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Frederica Wilson is a U.S. House of Representative Congresswoman representing the 24th Congressional District in Miami. Finally, on the roundup, when President Biden signed the bill making Juneteenth a federal holiday this week, he said, "Great nations don't ignore their most painful moments.
They don't ignore those moments in the past. They embrace them. Great nations don't walk away. We come to terms with the mistakes we made. And remembering those moments, we begin to heal and grow stronger."
Last year on Juneteenth, WLRN asked historians to share with us stories of Black history in South Florida, stories that may be forgotten or buried because of the reminders of race and racism.
Hi, I'm Nathan Connolly. I teach history at Johns Hopkins University, and I wrote the book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. Jim Crow was an elaborate system of racial regulation, very similar to apartheid in South Africa. And as with apartheid, South Florida had what's known as a pass system or a police card system that was used to monitor workers who lived on the colored side of town in, say, the Central Negro District or present-day Overtown, maybe the Black section of Coconut Grove, but who worked in Miami Beach, where, during World War II, there was a curfew in effect. You see, there was actually concern during the war that you had Nazi spies who, by way of submarine, were coming onto the beaches and basically stealing secrets because the American military had created all these bases up and down in the former hotels and parks of Miami Beach. In order to monitor the spies, the pass card program was created, but it was implemented and it evolved to monitor people of African descent in the context of Jim Crow. Now, the card itself was actually quite simple. It just had a photograph, a thumbprint. It had a description on the back about where you worked. But in its practice, it could be used by police, military officials, and even everyday whites to basically monitor whether Black folk were out of place after curfew. Miami Beach had a 10 p.m. curfew, in fact. And so you could work without incident, really, until about 10 o'clock. But once 10 o'clock hit, you had to be back across the causeway, across Biscayne Bay, back into Colortown, or you needed a card to explain where exactly you worked and why you were out of place. Now, it may be shocking for you to learn that the Pass Card program, even though it was established in the heart of the Jim Crow period, was used in informal ways well into the 1980s. And in fact, as a historian coming down to South Florida to do research, I learned of people carrying these cards around well into the 2000s. It really is an artifact of an apartheid era in the United States, in Miami, and really on this Juneteenth, it's a reminder that America's racial history is really not as far away as we'd sometimes like to think.
Historian Nathan Connolly is a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. He wrote the book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow, South Florida. And that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It's produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting Public Radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.